Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In April, the Utah State University alumni, students, faculty, and staff representing the Hiravi Peace Institute traveled to Uzbekistan to attend the Diplomacy of the Heart Conference, an international gathering dedicated to intercultural understanding and peacebuilding. Celebrating the dignity of difference, the conference brought together scholars, students, and peacebuilders from across the world to explore how literature, law, religion, and youth leadership intersect in global peace efforts. So today we're going to talk about peacebuilding in general. In this conference in specific, we'll talk with two of the participants. Emma Martins is an international study student pursuing global peacebuilding certificate at USU. So Emma Martins, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Austin Nuppy is Hiravi Peace Institute Director and USU Assistant Professor of Political Science. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Let's get to know each of you a little bit more, and then we'll talk about the conference and the peace building in general. Emma, international studies student?
Yeah, I'm pursuing a major in political science right now with a double minor in religious studies and Arabic, and of course a certificate in global peace building.
Okay, so what do you, this is the question you always get, I imagine, right? What do you want to do with that?
Oh, that is the question. Yeah. You know, I feel like I change my mind with every class I take. You know, I take a human rights class, I want to be a human rights lawyer. I take a negotiations class, I want to be a negotiator. But ultimately, the end goal is to do some sort of work revolving around human rights, whether that be diplomacy, but I certainly want emphasis on international experiences.
All right, yeah. And you're a couple years away from your degree?
Yeah, I'm just starting my junior year, so I got about 2 years left.
Yeah. So what did you want the peacebuilding certificate?
Yeah, so the Global Peacebuilding Certificate offered through the HPI was something that's become really important for me to take. I think oftentimes when, you know, we think of creating change, we think of politics, which is certainly an important part of it. But the Global Peacebuilding Certificate is really showing me the different mechanisms for change to pursue peace and has shown me that peace is really possible and not naive.
Yeah. So Austin Uppy, before we get into your background a little bit, I want to pull this up. You wrote a piece with Tammy Proctor in the Deseret News. It was, I think, around the time the Hiravi Peace Institute was instituted. And you say in this piece, peace builders are of limited ability unless they possess character traits and practical skills that will form and sustain them as people of peace in Utah and beyond. So I guess that's what you're doing at the Institute.
Yeah, so we train students, faculty, and staff on Utah State's campuses in Logan and statewide, as well as members of the Logan community, to learn about how to navigate conflict. I think a lot of times we have the implicit assumption that conflict is negative. And so what we end up doing is either being conflict averse or conflict acceptant. We either avoid conflict based on the assumption that'll create peace, or we lean into it and we be conflictual. But what we want to do at the HPI is to train our students, faculty, and staff to navigate conflict effectively. And so we've been around about 3 years, started in 2022, through the gift of Utah State alumnus Dr. Mehdi Hiravi, who has both academic and practical experience with that in Iran and also in the United States. So our curriculum is multidisciplinary, but we have three pillars that we really lean in on when we train our students. We want students to have the character of peace, so we focus on character traits. Those are exercised and built through relationships, using skills and developing habits that lead to healthy conflict negotiation, whether that's interpersonally or in families or in a diplomatic setting internationally. So we have character traits. We teach students and staff the theories of conflict and how conflicts transform into peace. So there's an academic study side, both on campus and overseas in our experiential learning opportunities. And then we also train students, faculty, and staff in the tools or skills of peace building, whether that's interpersonal or in larger groups, conflict facilitation methods, or then also in global diplomacy among states. So we focus on traits, theories, and tools across a variety of disciplines.
Mm. I want to focus on those two. There are probably more, but two key or main or typical responses to conflict, right?
Sure, sure.
And so I think that, you know, conflict avoiders, I raise my hand here, right? Dr. Canfield, Claire Canfield, when he does these workshops, right?
Yep.
He has you do
yep.
a metaphor for conflict, you know, broken glass. People hate conflict, right?
Yep.
But I think sometimes people think if I just avoid the conflict, that is peace, but it's not, right?
Right. Right. So Professor Canfield has a great program called Conversational Space Making, which trains students to negotiate interpersonal conflicts with roommates or in dorm life or in their families or in the classroom. And so he's really offers practical tools and training there. But I've also found, I'm a scholar of international politics. I focus on the Middle East. I found the tools that someone like Professor Canfield teaches also apply to global negotiations. And so you see whether it's President Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu or Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, now you see the same sort of conflict negotiation, conflict management skills at play on the global stage. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they're dealing with conflict far, it's a more toxic expression of that than what we see in healthy conflict transformation. But, you know, those tools and understandings of the drivers of conflict and how people navigate that scale from the interpersonal to the international, which makes it really exciting.
So as a scholar of this, you must, I don't know if you see these negotiations or whatever it is, international relations on a grand scale.
Right.
And you're thinking, no, apply this, right? Or no, apply that. Or maybe sometimes, yes, you're in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what we've seen in the Israel-Gaza conflict right now and also with the United States and Iran is negotiations are just one form of bargaining or negotiation. We bargain in our marriages and in our families and classrooms. We also bargain internationally. And those negotiations are tricky at the international level because there's endemic uncertainty and misperception about both what your allies and your adversaries seek to do. And so what you're trying to do is not just credibly threaten or coerce an adversary, you also need to credibly reassure them that if they comply with the negotiated settlement, peace settlement, whatever it is, that you will withhold some form of punishment or further violence. And oftentimes, like we're seeing now with Iran, it's often harder to succeed with credible reassurance than it is issuing credible threats.
Yeah.
So
the other inclination for some people is to lean into the conflict.
That's right.
Then
right.
That's not going to produce peace.
Right. And oftentimes you'll see individuals or groups frame or reframe conflict around a zero-sum game. So what they say is, Tom, in order for this conflict to end, I need to win and you need to lose. It's not a win-win situation. These are existential stakes. They're tied to my emotional well-being. They're tied to some core identity trait, my ethnicity, race, the country on my passport, my religion, whatever it is. And so conflict acceptant folks typically lean into those and they approach a conflict through the lens of a courtroom. So they are a lawyer who's marshaling evidence in order to win, and they need to make sure that their adversary understands the hurt and grievance they're suffering. And they somehow think that if they enter this grievance-forward, rational process, that somehow they can persuade or coerce or change someone's mind. And they actually have that backwards. You know, we're programmed to be relational, emotional creatures. Emotions shape how we make rational decisions. And so the cognitive and emotional are connected. So you need to connect with someone in terms of their emotional state, their values, maybe a shared social identity, if you have any hope in wanting to persuade someone.
Mm-hmm. I'll turn back to Emma Martins. One question I asked Professor Nuppe, you know, peace-building tools, right, writ large. I want to ask you the reverse. So you're learning some of these techniques, right, in your classroom. Are you ever tempted or have you applied that in interpersonal, you know, with your roommates or whatever, right? You know, hey, I've learned this. Let's try this.
Yeah. And that's always the goal, you know, kind of like you said earlier, I am a conflict avoider. So it does not come naturally to me to engage in conflict in a healthy way. But, you know, I recently took a class with, you know, Claire Canfield, who you talked a little bit about in some of his workshops. And the goal is always to constantly be applying the, you know, actual skills and tools that we're learning. You know, when we think of conflict and the tools to solve it, we think of, you know, effective dialogue and communication. And we often think that those skills come naturally. And we forget that we actually have to practice those and be really intentional about it. So when it comes to applying these in everyday life, I have to really remind myself and think of it every step of the way. Pause. Let me actually implement this. And it takes a while to develop, but eventually it becomes more natural.
So you have developed it over time.
I'm developing.
It's a
work in progress.
Yeah, yeah. So it can actually work.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've definitely seen results in my own life.
You mentioned you're learning Arabic.
Yeah.
Right? So that would lead me to believe you're wanting international relations. You wanted to drive right into the middle of some of the worst conflict, Middle East.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely a point of interest right now, a lot going on over there. I certainly have a strong interest in the Middle East. And so Arabic for me is definitely a way to be more connected to that and to tap into it. With some of the focus I want to do on international relations, I would love to do work in the Middle East. I think it's incredibly important to actually learn the language if you're going to effectively communicate, which we've learned is an important part of the peace building process.
So what's the driving goal here? Justice, peace, sometimes those can be in conflict, right? But what do you want to accomplish?
You know, ultimately for me is a positive peace. You know, like you said earlier, peace doesn't always mean, happiness or justice, because sometimes people think of peace as just a lack of conflict, which isn't always a good thing. But for me, a positive peace, which means, a lack of conflict, but a presence of justice. So making sure there's actual structural reforms going along with it, that, cultural violence is put to an end as well. So positive peace centered around human rights is a real focus of my passion and my work that I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. So Professor Nuppe, what's your definition of peace?
I think on the positive side, so we tend to, at the HPI, we tend to think about positive and negative peace. Negative peace would be the absence of violence. So right now in Tehran or in Gaza City or in Rafah, there's a negative peace. There's no, there's the absence of U.S. or Israeli military attacks. Now that's incredibly fragile, and it often comes at the expense of justice. So I think what we want to pivot toward or work toward is positive peace, which is a more comprehensive view of human flourishing. How do we create relationships, societies, states where people can be more human, where not only their basic needs are provided for, food, shelter, water, physical safety, but also relational needs and the psychological or spiritual needs of being having a meaningful life, having something to contribute, even if it's at a small scale. And so there's a big tension there. And I think often folks that are skeptical of this idea of peace building or somehow conflict transformation have their finger on something that's absolutely true. And that's, we talk about navigating conflict. There are some conflicts that are irresolvable, but you can navigate them without resorting to violence. So there are oftentimes really deep conflicts of understanding or interest in terms of our values, metaphysical truths, things that make us who we are, that we're not going to come to a modus vivendi on. We're not going to resolve those issues. Think about maybe the issue of abortion in the United States. That's one example. You can still navigate that in a way that is healthy conflict as opposed to escalating into violence, right? So it's really not solving. There's a field called conflict resolution. A lot of times the conflicts we're engaging in or the spaces we're entering into listen are not issues that are going to be resolvable in the course of a 15-week semester, even our lifetimes. And so that there's a tension there. And then like what Emma said about that tension between negative peace on the one hand and positive peace on the other.
Mm. You've been involved, Professor Nuppe, with a center called the Conflict to Peace. Is it a center, institute? I can't remember.
Yeah, there's a research lab we started at Ohio State about 10 years ago looking at conflict transformation there. I was started in collaboration with Dr. Terry Murphy, who leads the Mershon Center of International Studies at Ohio State. And in a lot of work, she's a scholar practitioner. So has worked in Northern Ireland, in the Balkans, and in Turkey as well, now teaching full-time at Ohio State. So that was kind of a model. I was a PhD student when I got involved in that lab, and that served as a template or model for what we're doing here now at Utah State University.
Yeah. This, I think, probably gets into what you were just saying, which is conflict to peace, right? So some conflicts will never be resolved, but you can navigate them in a more peaceful manner.
Sure. So you can think about the types of conflicts that I spend my time researching, teaching, and doing field work around, a place like the Balkans or the Middle East, Iraq, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Yemen. These are places where they have really deep ethno-sectarian cleavages, real deep difference around ethnicity and religion. And oftentimes there are peace settlements that create negative peace and hopefully build a stable expectation or some stability towards long-term peace. Sometimes that's partition. You look at what happens with the collapse of the former Yugoslavia. Unfortunately, there's not lots of positive peace being built in places like Bosnia nowadays. But one of the solutions there after the Bosnian War 1994 and Kosovo 1998 was to partition states.
Yeah.
That may be a solution. For me, I think Israel-Palestine right now, we have a one-state reality. But one of the more promising paths still is a two-state solution based on pre-1967 borders, capital in East Jerusalem. Right, the architecture of that agreement that failed at Camp David in 2000 is still there. The political will is completely absent, but that would be a way of navigating a conflict without necessarily resolving underlying tensions, grievances, differing interests, right?
Yeah, yeah. Just before we go to break, Emma Martins again, you must be hopeful about this, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't go into this, right? I mean, it seems hopeless right now, at least to me.
I mean, it's certainly easy to feel hopeless, but I think that's one strength youth and peace building have on our side, is we tend to be more hopeful, we tend to be more motivated. And I think I'll always carry that with me, you know, especially seeing what's, you know, going on in the news and everything around the world. It can be really easy to feel unmotivated. But there's also a little bit of selection bias in the media as well, right? The positive outcomes don't get covered as often. And so it's also really important to understand that as much hardship is going on in the world, there is also many instances of peace building that has been successful and that does work.
And hopeful that people like you are going into this, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's do a quick break. We are talking with two of the participants in a conference we're going to get into talking about in the second segment of the program. Several alumni, students, faculty, and staff from Utah State University represented the Harabi Peace Institute, went to Uzbekistan in April to attend the Diplomacy of the Heart Conference. We're talking to two of the participants. Emma Martins is an international studies student pursuing a global peacebuilding certificate at USU, and Austin Nuppe is Harabi Peace Institute director and USU assistant professor of political science. We'll have more following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are talking about peacebuilding on the program today. Several alumni, students, faculty, and staff representing the Harabi Peace Institute from Utah State University traveled to Uzbekistan in April to attend the Diplomacy of the Heart Conference. We're talking with two of those participants, Emma Martins, international studies student at Utah State University, and Austin Nuppe, the Harabi Peace Institute director. So, Austin Nuppe, I was going to have you introduce yourself in general, then we got on to other things. So, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, I've been at Utah State since August 2020. I was hired here in the political science department to teach international politics. My emphasis, passion is for Middle East politics in particular, also looking at the Middle East through the lens of U.S. foreign policy. So I've been doing that the last 5 years. Had a book come out last year called Surviving the Islamic State, which looks at the role, resilience, and suffering of Iraqi civilians under insurgent occupation with the Islamic State. So it was a study there, involved field work, some surveys, some quantitative analysis, spent a lot of time in the region thinking about how ordinary people survive conflict-affected communities. Mm-hmm. Done that, and then in the last couple of months have taken over the directorship of the HPI, looking forward to leading that institution in a time of a lot of turbulence, uncertainty, and change. Yeah.
We had you on previously. We talked about the book. Tell me just a little bit about that for people who missed that conversation.
Sure. Yeah, so I was looking at the transition that happens in Iraq after the Americans leave in 2010 and with the rise of the Islamic State. Basically, ISIS emerges as Al-Qaeda 2.0, yet it critically different in that it has lots of Iraqis and Syrians that join the ranks. And so in June 2014, early in that summer, you had a major military offensive by ISIS in Iraq and Syria. By the end of August, 3 months later, roughly about 40% of Iraqi territory is occupied by the Islamic State. And then the United States and Iraqi security forces lead a coalition to defeat ISIS. It takes about 4 years and lots of destruction, human suffering in both states. So I was looking at that lens not through military effectiveness or military history. I was zooming in on the local, looking at the micro level, trying to understand a couple key questions, right, or a couple key decisions. How do civilians in really difficult circumstances decide, one, whether to stay or whether to leave, right? Most of us have the motivation to leave facing violence. The problem is not all of us have the opportunity to do so. So the question of why do you stay or leave is a function not only of motive but also opportunity. And then the second is, more tragically, for those who stay in these communities, they face really difficult decisions on how to survive. Most of us in that situation would keep our head down. We would hide, stay out of harm's way, stay out of trouble. Right? You can only do that so far, because at some point you need to venture out for food, medicine, propane for your stove to cook, right? Things like that. And at that point, individuals face the decision of whether or not to collaborate or resist these groups. So I was kind of looking at like a multi-step decision process.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So let's get into talking about the conference here in Uzbekistan. Very interesting. So Emma Martins, I understand you won your seat at the conference by being one of the winners of the Baskerville Institute's writing competition. What did you write?
Yeah, so I wrote a paper focusing on youth in peace building and specifically the struggles they face in not only entering the field but also staying in the field. You know, as a young person, you're going to face a lot of challenges, especially when it comes to developing the actual skills you need to be a peace builder. You know, kind of like I talked about earlier, when it comes to solving conflict, you need skills like effective communication, tolerance, advocacy, assertiveness. And we tend to think of those things that come naturally, and part of it does. But youth oftentimes actually lack the space to practice those and really develop those skills specifically. And on top of that, they lack the tools to actually implement those skills in practice and affect change in a meaningful way. So my paper focused on those two issues that youth face and highlighted, you know, civil society and NGOs as potential solutions, specifically utilizing speech and debate to give youth a space to develop those.
Oh, great. Have you been involved in speech and debate?
I have, yeah. Yeah. I did speech and debate in high school, and yeah, it was a really formative experience for me.
Yeah, well, that's great, yeah. I always say speech and debate, I learned more on that than I did in most classes in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it really broadens your perspective on everything.
It really does. Practices, right? Debate can be, a tool for peace building, Professor.
Absolutely, right. So the idea of productive disagreements, that really at the heart of what universities do, which is discover and disseminate knowledge that hopefully contributes to human flourishing. So we use conflict as a mechanism or a vehicle to discover the true, the good, and the beautiful, and then passing that on to students and enriching our communities in the process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned the Baskerville Institute. Just mentioned here that the conference in Uzbekistan was organized by the Baskerville Institute with sponsorship from the Sterling Foundation, the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy, BYU Law, the Harabi Peace Institute, and numerous institutions from Central Asia. And the event took place in Samarkand from April 27th to 29th. So, Professor Nopi, what was this conference?
Yeah, so Dr. Bakhtiari at the Baskerville Institute in Salt Lake City reached out to collaborate on bringing students, faculty, and staff together in really a classic Silk Road city, in an amazing country in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. A large part of it was to bring students together. We had students from University of Utah, BYU, and Utah State University, with students from Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, to have a meaningful conversation and conference the first day of the conference. And then faculty staff made presentations the next day. And it really was a forum for convening people and building relationships after about 3 days or so. Did some field excursions, visited a really historically significant city called Bukhara, which is another Silk Road city, kind of the crossroads of Russian and Persian and Arabic and Islamic civilization. And so, yeah, we spent about 3 days together, folks from Utah and then Central Asia. And Harabi Institute was glad to co-sponsor that and be a part of it.
So Silk Road, I guess the idea here is crossroads. You're
exactly.
Interchange, building peace that way.
Yeah, and so it's historically and symbolically important, even as it had people from all over the world convening in this small city for a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Emma, imagine, I don't know if this was on your bucket list, visit Uzbekistan. Probably not a lot of people's. tell me about Uzbekistan, Samarkand.
Yeah, I hadn't initially been on my radar, but when I found out the opportunity offered through the Baskerville Institute, you know, it immediately piqued my interest. And going to Uzbekistan was definitely such a formative experience for me, especially, you know, at the time I was taking my Introduction to Islam class. And so to see some of those amazing, you know, UNESCO World Heritage Sites, you know, as I'm taking these classes and learning about Islamic history and seeing it right in front of me, it was just amazing.
Yeah. What kind of a place is Samarkand? Large, small?
It felt, not too far different. I spent most of my time at the conference, and, we did have some excursion days. But it's just really a beautiful, beautiful city. And, mm-hmm. We got to go to, some of the, open-air markets and buy everything and, some of the, madrasas and the history. The United States is relatively young compared to some of these other places. And so actually being able to see some of this architecture that is so much older than our country as a whole was just really amazing.
Same question to you, Professor. What was your impression of Uzbekistan?
Well, I think there's a lot of folks at the conference on interreligious dialogue and diplomacy through different religious perspectives. And what struck me about a place like Uzbekistan is that, it joined the Soviet Union in 1920. So it had been a Soviet state for almost 100 years or about 80 years. And they have, it's in southern Uzbekistan where Samarkand is, they're majority Dari or Farsi speaking Muslim. And in the aftermath of the Soviet Union, Islam has made more of a comeback in terms of being a part of public life. And the Uzbeks have found a model of religious pluralism where under the Soviet Union, religion was repressed from a variety of corners. Now it's not, I wouldn't call a place like Samarkand Islamist, but Islam is public, forward in the public square. You don't necessarily hear the call to prayer. People take prayer breaks at mosques that are open. So it's in a lot of ways an interesting laboratory case study on religious pluralism in a part of the world that has lots of conflicts that involve a religious dimension. They may be not explicitly religiously motivated. That may not be the main driver of conflict, but it's certainly a key feature. And so I was encouraged by what I saw there.
Mm. So understand, Emma Martins, you participated in a youth workshop designed to highlight the role of students as agents of peace. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was really great. So the day before the conference was a student workshop. There were 10 students presenting. About half of them were from the United States, and the other half were from Central Asia. And, essentially it just gave us time to share our thoughts on peace building, really connect with each other, and to actually be heard. I talked earlier about how youth struggle to actually get access to a space that gives them any, meaningful opportunities to create change. And so this was definitely a great opportunity to actually experience that.
Yeah, interesting. Students from where? I guess all over?
Yeah, so, there were the 5 students, from Utah, and then there was a student from Kazakhstan, a couple students from Iran, and I think that mainly covered it. But some of them, while even being from Iran, lived in other countries. So definitely a very worldly experience, had a lot of really valuable mm-hmm. cultural perspectives.
Speaking in English?
It was mostly English-speaking. Mm-hmm. All the students that presented did present in English. Some of the other presenters had translators, but yeah.
Yeah. We were fortunate. English is kind of a lingua franca at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
throughout,
sure.
Throughout the world, yeah. That's changed over time, various eras, but right now, kind of lucky if you're an English speaker. So Dr. Nuppy, what did you present? What were you involved in at the conference?
Yeah, so I presented a broader outlook on the mission and vision of the HBI. So I kind of walked through our theory of change, or kind of the intellectual DNA of the Institute in terms of character traits, theories of conflict and peace, and tools or skills. So I walked through that and then talked about the 4 different areas in which the HBI operates. So we're an educational institution, so we do lots of education in the classroom and also in the field. Experiential learning is a really key cornerstone to what we're trying to do. And the best way that we found to do that is not just only or primarily students, but also combining students, alumni, staff, donors, where you have an intergenerational mission to a place for 2 or 3 weeks. We found a lot of fruit is reaped through that kind of model of doing study abroad or service learning, if you would. That's the first. The second is we support research. We support faculty developing curriculum, so like Claire Canfield's Spacemakers Program, Chad Ford's Mediation Curriculum, my book on Iraq. Elsewhere, we have colleagues working on academic research and more practical or applied curriculum. We then have a whole emphasis, that third cornerstone is on praxis, which is basically a fancy word for putting practices into action. we learn these tools, but we then need to habitualize ourselves or build healthy habits around those. So praxis is a key dimension. And the fourth is community engagement, talking to folks like yourself about really difficult issues without a sense of tempered hope. We're not naive optimists and we're not exhausted cynics. So we do lots of engagement here on the Logan campus at Utah State University and also throughout our statewide and extension enterprises as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is just totally random. I'll throw this at you. I was thinking if
I'll have Emma take it.
I'll have you both take it, but Professor, if I had you in my friend group, you know, and I knew you as the peacebuilding guy, right? I might throw that in your face, or I might apply more pressure. Do you get that in your friend group, your family? Hey, you're the peacebuilding guy. Why aren't you following these principles right now? Or on the other hand, hey, you're the peacebuilding guy. What can we do? How can we solve this?
So both and. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think there's a cynicism or skepticism to that. Some of that's a healthy skepticism. We call that wisdom or discernment, being able to sniff out things that don't seem quite right. And then there's also a fair amount of book passing. Well, you know, I'm not trained in this. This is, you're the expert. And, you know, one of the things there is, as we operate in these different relationships, it actually reflects how we're living our lives at the HPI. And then what we're doing is we're training and living life together with the expectation that most of us are not going to be professional peace builders. The people that build a vocation with that specific set of skills and theories is pretty narrow. Everyone that walks through the doors of the HPI, either whether it's a general education course on the one hand or an advanced course or study abroad on the other, is going to have to use those skill sets in the course of their normal vocation. So we're training teachers and doctors and nurses and political scientists who also happen to be peace builders. And so along the way, you realize that when you develop these habits in the context of relationship, the character traits of a peace builder is one of active listening and a lot of humility, being really quick to learn what it means to apologize to someone sincerely, to pursue private forgiveness and also public reconciliation. You can't really enter into the space if you're not have a healthy appraisal of your own ego and ability.
Mm-hmm. So the students, the people that come to this field are, I guess, self-selecting.
Certainly.
So that it provides character traits that people want this, right? But
yeah.
But then you layer in the skills on top of that.
Yeah, so we start out and cast a vision about surrounding what are the type of people we want to become, right? What would it mean for our little institute at one regional land-grant university to contribute to human flourishing? Like, what are those ultimate goals, those vision-based goals? And then we, along the way, over the course of 2, 3, 4-plus years, then study and learn together the theories of conflict, and then also lean into those skills and tools. And then you cultivate those character traits. A lot of us, I think there's a misunderstanding that peacemakers are only peacemakers by temperament. If you're not a peaceable person, you can't be a peace builder, and that's just wrong, right? These are not temperaments. They're character traits, or they're dispositions that you have to exercise, just like if you were training for a century bike race or a marathon or swimming event or anything else.
Yeah. I want to ask the same question to you, Emma Martins. I don't know if you're known in your circle of friends maybe they know you're getting your global peace building certificate and, you know, international relations. You have your goals, right? You probably share this with some of your friends. Either way, right? Hey, you're the peace builder, you know. Why don't you bring some peace here? It's not me. Or, hey, how can we navigate this?
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, kind of like Dr. Nuppy said, there's certainly a level of skepticism that comes with it. You know, I interact with a lot of STEM majors who are like, oh, you're in peace building. And they think we're just sitting in a circle holding hands and singing songs. But I think my favorite part about interacting with people like that is being able to discuss with them what peace building actually is and the fact that it's actually a practical field with real skills to develop that is pursuable and it is real and it is important. We tend to think of peace builders as naive, and so I love having those conversations because they realize that that's actually not the case. But I do also experience the other side of it, where it's, oh, you're the expert here. You handle this conflict, or people asking, you know, for advice. And you know, the approach there is always not to give advice, but to, you know, set people on their own path. You know, invite them to look more into peace building. Because you don't want to tell people what to do, but you want to hopefully encourage them to develop their skills so that they can better navigate their own conflicts in their own life.
Yeah. Early in the program, you raised your hand as a conflict avoider, right? Many of us are. It's not easy for anybody, right? Harder for some than others, right? Have you been able to navigate that? Are you navigating conflict a little better now with some of these tools?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've seen significant improvement, especially, you know, and I just started, you know, pursuing the peacebuilding certificate just two semesters ago. So it's been about a year, and I've seen major improvements for me in, you know, my personal life and the relationships that I have. You know, whether it's on a personal level or whether it's even in my working relationships, you just see it affect at every point. And so, and being really intentional about actually, you know, applying some of the skills I'm using, trying to be an active listener, trying not to avoid so much and to actually remind myself to be present in the situation has just been a really helpful and valuable skill. And mm-hmm. I'm happy to have seen the benefits from it.
Yeah, that is hopeful. That is hopeful for us mm-hmm. all, right? Yeah. Personal and then between nations. Let's take another break. We'll come back with final segment. We are talking about a peacebuilding conference in Uzbekistan. Several people from USU went. And we're talking to the participants. Emma Martins, an international studies student pursuing the Global Peacebuilding Certificate at USU, and Austin Nuppe, who is Harari Peace Institute Director and USU Assistant Professor of Political Science. We'll talk more about peacebuilding following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Excuse me. Last April, Utah State University alumni, students and faculty and staff representing the Harari Peace Institute traveled to Uzbekistan to attend a Diplomacy of the Heart conference, a peacebuilding conference, and we've talked about that. And we're talking in general about peacebuilding. We're talking with two of the participants in that conference. Emma Martins is an international studies student at USU pursuing the Global Peacebuilding Certificate at USU. And Austin Nuppe is Harari Peace Institute Director and USU Assistant Professor of Political Science. So, Emma Martins, I want to start this segment by asking you about another conference that you attended. This was last year. Weaving Our Stories, Utah State University's Commitment to Indigenous Strength. This was a Weaving Our Stories conference, Indigenous Strengths for Inclusive Excellence. It's in Blanding, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about this.
Yeah, so it was, I believe, a two-day-long conference is focused on uplifting Native voices and, you know, trying to increase connection between, you know, the main campus and the Blanding campus where, you know, a lot of our Native students attend. I myself and a couple other students attended. We didn't present, but we were there to observe and to, you know, hopefully engage and interact with some of the other Native students there. We saw some really, you know, impressive presentations, and we left feeling a lot more knowledgeable about, you know, not only what our university was doing, but what more we could do to actually keep engagement with those Native students. And I think, you know, between the Weaving Our Stories conference and the Diplomacy of the Heart conference, the biggest thing was, you know, being able to foster connection, right? We talk a lot in peace. Really big part of peace is relationship building and having connection. And we tend to think of, you know, trying to establish connections with those who are, you know, older than us or more powerful, you know, to help us learn and mentor. But we forget to establish connections with the people who are our age, who are students, who are so smart and talented and ready to make an impact in the world. And so between those two conferences, I just really enjoyed being able to actually connect with my peers who were just as motivated as I was, and to hopefully continue working with them in the future to create a real change.
Tell me a bit more about forming those connections, because we do form connections kind of naturally, but I guess maybe it tends to be in your own group or, you know, people, like-minded people. You have to be more intentional, I guess, to form connections across divides.
Yeah, you know, and I can speak to that, especially, you know, being a peacebuilding student, it tends to be a small cohort, you know, when you're taking this set amount of classes, you see the same people every day, and it almost becomes an echo chamber, you know, you're hearing a lot of the same things. And so going to a conference like that, and especially Diplomacy of the Heart, where I'm now interacting every day with students from around the world, was a really valuable experience. And it's a connection that I'm continuing to keep. You know, we have, you know, group chats where, you know, with everything happening in the world right now, we're constantly talking, sharing perspectives. And it's been really valuable insight to maybe leave the Western narrative and understand, you know, the people who are on the ground who are actually experiencing this in real time, what their perspective is.
Yeah, interesting. So Austin Nuppe, tell me a little bit more about Harari Peace Institute.
Yeah, so we've been around since 2022. And it was a vision spearheaded by Dr. Mehdi Harari, who's been around Utah State a long time. He's an alumnus of our institution in the early 1960s and pursued a PhD at American University in political science, taught here in the United States, and then also served as the provost of the University of Tehran in the mid-1970s. And so he started that position, and then within several years, or just a few years, in fact, in 1979, there's a Islamic revolution in Iran that changed the government from an authoritarian monarch under the Shah, monarchy under the Shah, to an Islamic theocracy under Ayatollah Khomeini. And so Dr. Harabi has the academic expertise, spent a lot of years teaching, researching, doing that. Also, as an alumnus, really saw the need, having lived through conflict himself personally, of investing in institutions he cares about. Thankfully, that includes Utah State. And with a special concern for supporting students, giving them opportunities to build those skills and relationships here in Logan and overseas in a context that's relatively peaceful, right? That they can get a head start on those without having to go through the same forms of suffering that Dr. Harabi did early on in his career. And so he's been a regular feature here at Utah State. He's given money for a world languages building there on the Quad, and he supported, continues to support, and in fact travel with the HBI. He was one of our delegates at the Diplomacy of the Heart Conference, so it's great to see him engaged. He was able to speak both in English and Farsi to our Iranian friends and colleagues there, and just has a lot of energy, enthusiasm, really an entrepreneurial mindset about how to expand the reach and influence of the HBI and Utah State. What comparative advantage or real expertise skills do we have? How can we make some place like Logan, Utah, ground zero for peacebuilding training, have it be a location where people come to study and build relationships around that? And so we're excited to continue that mission and vision. We're going to be expanding here in the coming academic year, and really thankful for the support of Dr. Harabi, the support of the Dean Joe Ward, who leads the College of Arts and Sciences, as well as President Smith and others that are leading the university through this transition period. Really thankful and excited about their support, and looking forward to seeing what's coming this coming year.
I'll just mention Dr. Harabi. I have had the opportunity to interview him a couple of times. You can find those interviews at upr.org. And very interesting man and a great philanthropist. And I'll mention the Dr. Mehdi Harabi Student Scholarship at USU, or UPR, Utah
That's
Public
right.
Radio. We thank him greatly for that scholarship. He has institute scholarships in many departments across the university. So to conclude here, so looking forward, tell me what's next for you, Emma Martins.
Yeah, you know, as I continue on my peacebuilding journey, gaining those practical experiences and continuing to have international experiences is so important. So I have a lot to thank the Harabi Peace Institute for. You know, I received scholarship from them, and you know, it's a lot of help. And actually having the resources to continue to develop the skills I need and to actually have access to the practical opportunities that are going to get me to the place I want in life, to actually have the skill sets to create the change that I want to work internationally. So the goal is just keep studying. Got two more years left of college, and hopefully I'll be on my way.
All right. Very good. Dr. Nupi, give you the last word here. What'd you like to say at the end of the conversation?
Yeah, you know, we're quite excited about what we're doing here. Coming year, we're bringing on new faculty. Dr. Lady Ajayi is coming to us from Ithaca College. She'll be teaching our core peacebuilding curriculum. Professor Amanda Ford in social work will be joining us as well. So we're offering more courses. We'll have some study abroad opportunities here. Going to Morocco next May, Rwanda. I'll be leading a mission of students and staff to Rwanda next July. We'll be going back to the Balkans in the coming year. So we'd love to have folks join us here at Utah State and also in the community. And check us out on at the College of Arts and Sciences website, Harabi Peace Institute. Look at our mission vision. If you feel so inclined, donate some money to support our students. That goes to good use, supporting both students here in Logan and also in experiential learning opportunities overseas. So look forward to what's to come. Thanks so much for having us.
All right. Wonderful. So that's Austin Duffy. He's Harabi Peace Institute Director and USU Assistant Professor of Political Science. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
We've also had with us Emma Martins, who's International Studies student with pursuing a Global Peacebuilding Certificate at USU. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.